You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Growing up, when I came home from school, I ate milk and cookies while checking out our local newspaper, The Freelance Star. I'd catch up with Peanuts and the gang in the funny pages, and then I'd turn to Ann Landers' advice column, which is where I could get a peek into the problems of real-life grown-ups and find out what other people thought they should do about them. But the competing columns of Ann Landers and her twin sister, Dear Abby, were preceded by other enterprising female advice columnists who actually changed the face of newspapers in the early 20th century. Here with their stories is Julie Golia. She's the author of Newspaper Confessions, A History of Advice Columns in a Pre-Internet Age. Welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thanks, Tenery.
So I have to ask you, do you read advice columns or do you have a favorite subreddit where you go?
That's
for
a great question. I definitely read quite a bit of advice online. And I think, but I wouldn't say that's not what inspired the book, actually, really interestingly. I think I came to advice after I started getting interested in the columns from the earlier years. And one thing that I think really struck me about them is actually just the tone is so different now in a lot of ways. There's a sense of irony or sort of quiet, I think a little bit of sarcasm or self-referentialism of 21st century advice columns that you really don't see a ton of in the early columns. They're all a lot more earnest than we are today. But one thing that I think is really similar is the role of advice in fostering community and fostering the sharing of many, many opinions, not just that of an expert advice giver. And I think, as you said, Reddit is a perfect place to find lots of different opinions and sometimes sarcastic opinions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was so interested to hear or to read your description of how early advice columns 100 years ago kind of fostered this online, you know, interactive, it's not online, obviously, but interactive chat room experience. So I'd like you to introduce us to the experience column and its creator.
Yeah, the experience column is really the birth of this project for me. There was a column that ran in the Detroit News from 1919 all the way until the 1980s, but I really focus on the period up to around 1942, that was called Experience. And it was called that because the woman who was giving advice was older. Her pen name was Nancy Brown. And she pitched this advice column by saying that she had experience, the experience that was needed to give generations of people really solid advice based on her own personal life and all the things that she had seen. And when it started in 1919, it looked a lot like your typical advice column of the time. Should I kiss this boy? I'm having trouble with my marriage. What's the right salad fork to use? And then if you jump forward about a year later, you see that the advice column has transformed utterly into something else. It has become a place where people are writing not necessarily to seek concrete advice, but just to tell their story, to find an outlet for the pain and the loneliness that they're feeling, and then to have other people writing in to really share their own similar experiences, or just to say, I hear you, I relate to you. And as I discovered this column, it couldn't have hit me harder that this looked like a chat room. This looked like the internet. Somebody coming with a problem and throwing it out into the ether and looking for feedback, but really looking for validation. And that's where I started to think about this tension between the new media that we understand today, the kind of the social media that we understand today, and that its origins didn't necessarily lie in the 1980s, but really in the 1910s and 20s.
Well, why did newspapers start publishing advice columns in the first place?
That's a great question. And I think when we think about the history of newspaper, we don't always think about the history of gender. But what I really would argue, and I argue in the book, is that this is a moment in which you see the gender transformation of the newspaper. In the 19th century, a lot of newspapers were funded by political parties, and they viewed their readers as voters. And if we're talking about the 19th century, we're talking, of course, about male voters. But as we move into the 20th century, there's a transformation going on within the newspaper business structure itself, in which their readers are no longer voters, no longer political players per se, although of course they are, they may very well be voting. they're buyers. And the reason for this is that newspapers come to be funded by advertising revenue. And around the turn of the 20th century, it's sort of almost self-evident to ad men of the time that the people who were the primary purchasers in families were not men, but women. And so how then do you appeal? How do you tell advertisers that your audience members are looking at their ads and that they're going to buy things? And this starts a real concerted campaign on the part of newspapers across the country to begin to appeal to women by creating women's pages, feature pages, fashion pages, the rise of really complex society pages. And this is an incredibly diverse array of material, not necessarily featured on the front page, but segregated into the back of the newspaper in what they called a women's page. And so I really see that from the beginning of the 20th century up until the 1960s and 70s as the heyday of the women's page. Well, though it's in a separate part of the newspaper, is one of the primary motivators of the financial structuring of newspapers at the time.
And the fact that this was kind of interactive, as we've already talked about, people are writing in. I mean, that's helpful for newspapers, right?
That's exactly right. And now I think it's really important to say that newspapers were creating women's pages for their bottom line, right? They wanted to draw women's eyes and get them to buy, you know, like laundry detergent and other things like that. But what women did with that was kind of another story. And so as you see more and more people writing into advice columns, in a lot of ways, like the column, the experience column that I described at the beginning of the interview, they begin to make them their own. But this is also a great boon to the newspapers themselves that can say, look, we got 25,000 letters last week. We are reaching the women that you want to see reading our newspaper and looking at your ads. And they're writing in over and over, and they are loyal customers. And so advice columns in a lot of ways were a dream to the business managers of newspapers because they provided quantifiable evidence of women's interests.
Mm. And I want to talk about all the many things that advice columns could do. But first, I'd like to just get back to laundry detergent because obviously, a lot of advice was about housekeeping, and I just want to know how did the columnist treat housekeeping?
I think one of the major messages that you'll see in advice columns written primarily by white women in mainstream newspapers was that women needed to do it all. And that may sound familiar to a lot of people, and it often sounded familiar to me as a woman writing a book and, you know, with a job and a family. Women were expected to keep a beautiful house. They were expected to keep both a beautiful house and a frugal house. They were expected to be everything to their husbands and their children, and they were expected to be practical. And in a lot of ways, as I read through advice column after advice column, I could feel the weight of expectations that women of the time must have felt, a dizzying array of messages that were almost impossible to live up to. And in this way, while I was writing about, you know, primarily the 1910s, 20s, and 30s, the messages that were in the newspaper at that time, while they may have given out a different vision of what the ideal woman was, it was no less impossible to be an ideal woman in the 1930s as it is today. Mm. And so there was that really, I think, remarkable through line. But, give us
an example of kind of a weighty pressure that you were struck by when you were reading some of these from the 30s.
Yeah. So there were enormous and really interactive conversations about the responsibility of women of maintaining a frugal household, right? And so women were expected to measure out recipes in such a way that they could extend the money that their husbands were bringing home in ways that seemed almost impossible to me. But then at the same time, you know, a message about the running of a household might the next day be followed by an advice column in which the columnist encouraged a woman to not be a drudge, but to be a beloved and happy figure in her household. So, and I remember reading that column and being like, these poor women, you know, they're at home counting that, you know, counting out the money that they have to make the most frugal meal possible. And this was this was in the 1930s. So at the height of the Depression. Mm-hmm. And then the next day that, you know, that same columnist might remind them, but you need to do that with a smile and never, ever show the sweat that you might have on your brow.
Oh, well, how much of do you think this is the writer's own morality filtering through, or at least the persona of the writer? I mean, did they feel compelled to have this kind of high-mindedness, you think?
Well, it's interesting because I did a little bit of digging into three of the most popular advice columnists at the time. And by learning a little bit about their biographies and comparing their own life experiences with the advice that they gave, I came to realize that each in their own way, each of these women actually kind of failed to live up to the advice that they gave themselves. Mm. And I have all the empathy in the world for them about that, because of course the advice that they were giving was impossible to attain. But one of the things I argue about the nature of the career of the advice columnists is that they were in a lot of ways one of the earliest celebrity journalists of the time. And they did something that was, I think, really novel and really representative of celebrity, which is that they interweaved their own life stories into their work. And so at a time when male journalists were touting the idea of objectivity, these were women who were saying our very femininity, our gender is what makes us the most, you know, the most appropriate people and really the only people who are qualified to do this work. And so, you know, one advice, all of the advice columnists in a lot of ways really had challenging family lives. And one of the most popular advice columnists of the time, her name was Dorothy Dix. And she, you know, wrote column after column about how women who, you know, sort of rejected motherhood were unnatural, and that it was a crime to marry a man and then not agree to give him a child, right? And she herself actually didn't have any children. And she married incredibly young. And she found out very quickly that her husband had a pretty significant and violent mental illness. And she took up newspaper work because her family was underwater financially and she was practically starving. And so all this time while she's saying, women, you need to put your husbands first, you belong in the home, you need to run a frugal household, she herself is the primary wage earner in her family. And she has a really fascinating story because her career spans, you know, five decades. And in the beginning of her career, she hides this husband and she tells the story about her life, about how she's incredibly happily married. Mm. And she really, you know, she came into newspaper work by chance and her husband was her priority. But, you know, as we get into the 1930s and 40s and she is a more established reporter, and as the gender norms of the time change, she becomes more and more comfortable with being much more honest about his mental illness and about her responsibilities for sort of keeping their family afloat. But it inspired a lot of pathos to see these women hold up these impossible standards and then they themselves never be able to reach them and then have to really hide them in a lot of ways.
We're speaking with Julie Golia. She's the author of Newspaper Confessions, A History of Advice Columns in a Pre-Internet Age. I'm curious about a phenomenon you identified where columnists facilitated crowdsourcing for people in need. I wonder if you could give us an example of that.
This is another, I think, really direct correlation to the way that the different functionalities of the internet today and the different functionalities of advice columns in the early 20th century. So there were a number of ways in which columnists facilitated the knowledge of the audience. And some of them were like almost the Craigslist of the, you know, 1920s or 1930s.
How do you mean?
Does anybody know what kind of plant this is? It has two sharp leaves and a grayish tint. And the columnist would pipe in and say, if anybody knows, right here, you know. Then you actually see a number of examples that remind me a little bit of like GoFundMes today. I mean, you see these particularly during the Depression where somebody would write to a columnist and they would say, I'm in need. My husband has lost his job. I have lost my job. My children don't have clothes to wear. And then the advice columnist would vet this. They would often go to the house and they would make observations about the family. And they would say, I can confirm that this family is in real need. And sometimes they would chime in with a kind of respectability politics, like their house is clean, you know. and then people would presumably write in and send money to help them. I found one example where a woman said, my husband has left us. He has, you know, brown hair and a mustache and his name is blah, blah, blah. And the columnist said, has anybody seen this man? And so in some ways she was using it almost as a missing persons kind of function. But I think the more lasting example of crowdsource interactions is in what were called the housekeeping forums. And one of the most the earliest and most beloved housekeeping forums was in the Boston Globe, and it started in 1884, and it lasted until the early aughts. Hmm. I mean, it's an absolutely remarkable phenomenon. It was called Confidential Chat, and there was actually no editorial voice. The editors operated completely behind the scenes, and women would write in with recipes. They would write in with information on how to potty train their children, how to make your own formula. And then they would also write in with their own personal stories. A lot of women wrote in about the deaths of their children. And it became almost a center for collective grief for people who had lost their children. Mm. People wrote in about their husband's infidelities, and they wrote in about their own infidelities. They wrote in talking about different aspects of Northeastern life. Have you been to, you know, this particular area in Boston? I'm writing in from New Hampshire. And these relationships would last, in some cases, over years and even decades. I mean, it's an absolutely remarkable thing. And what was so amazing is that it was wholly functional by the nature of the readers. There was nobody writing in to, you know, dialogue with them that was on the staff of the Boston Globe. And this was led completely by reader interaction. And it lasted for over a century.
Julie Golia is the author of Newspaper Confessions, A History of Advice Columns in a Pre-Internet Age. Coming right up, we'll meet the author of an advice column for Black women. And this author sometimes had a very different idea about marriage and divorce than most of her white counterparts. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. We're speaking with Julie Golia. She's the author of Newspaper Confessions, A History of Advice Columns in a Pre-Internet Age. So we have been discussing basically mainstream white women writing newspaper columns. And did they incorporate the experience of Black women, or were there separate newspapers that African Americans were reading at the time?
So the answer to the first part of your question, did they sort of speak to Black readers, is a pretty strong no. Advice columnists writing in what I call mainstream papers, which were almost always white papers in the sense that their ownership was white, their presumed readers were white, and their staff was almost completely white. They really tailored their content toward a white audience. Of course, we have no evidence to show whether or not Black readers wrote into advice columns. We have copious evidence that Black readers read these mainstream newspapers. That said, there was an incredibly vibrant and longstanding tradition of Black newspapers in the United States going back to the beginning of the 19th century, well before slavery ended in the United States. And by the time we get to the beginning of the 20th century, this is a thriving and very lucrative industry. One of the most popular newspapers in the United States, Black newspapers in the United States, was called the Chicago Defender. Like most Black papers, it was a weekly, but this paper had a almost national reach. And while it was published in Chicago, it had a significant circulation, particularly in the American South. and played a major role actually in the Great Migration, the moving of a lot of Black Southerners up to major cities like Chicago, New York, Detroit. It really, in fact, was a booster for that kind of migration. And so this also featured a really fascinating and I would say unique advice column that ran in The Defender from 1920 until 1930, called Advice to the Wise and Otherwise. And it was penned, it's such a great title, isn't it? Right. And it was written by an advice columnist who called herself Princess Mysteria.
Mm. And royalty, where did that come from?
Princess Mysteria, if you took it from Princess Mysteria, she was born at the foot of mountains in India, and she spoke a dozen languages, and she was basically a mesmerist, which meant that she could read your mind. And she was, by the time she started penning the column, a very well-known player on the vaudeville scene. And she traveled and performed with her husband, Prince Mysteria, and, you know, dazzled crowds with her ability to predict when they would have their first child and what they were thinking and when they were going to die and so on. Now, a little bit of digging on my part revealed a different biography. So Princess Mysteria was actually named Valida Hill. And she was born in the American South and herself was a great migration story. Her family moved from the South to Chicago in the 1st decade of the 20th century and established themselves there. And she met her husband and developed her vaudeville persona and did a pretty remarkable job of imitating what she perceived to be an East Indian accent. And she herself is actually, I think, a product of a very fascinating kind of byproduct of what I and other historians would call Black modernity of the time. This is, of course, the time when you see the rise of the Nation of Islam, the rise of a movement called the Shriners, and a vision of Black nationalism that really married the idea of a magnificent African and Asiatic past. And so Princess Mysteria is playing on these really, I think, strident Black nationalists, sort of a vision of Black pride that posited a past to be proud of, and one that really married Africanism with Orientalism.
Can you give me an example of something she might say in that vein?
Well, this is the really interesting part. Her advice did not read that way in any way. Her advice was enormously practical. Common ideas about Black respectability and even Christianity. And so while she takes these ideas on in her vaudeville persona, it is reflected in almost no way in the advice that she gives, which is some of the most practical advice that I encountered in the dozens of advice columnists that I encountered in this project.
So that's just from her performance, but in her writing, she's very practical. But was it different from what white women were writing about housekeeping?
It was remarkably different. And the most significant thing is that white columnists almost never counseled divorce. The only examples I found of encouraging women to leave their husbands were in moments of really, really violent abuse. And by contrast, Princess Mysteria takes a very liberal approach to the idea of divorce. In Princess Mysteria's view, women's priority had to be to their own independence and their own self-worth, and most importantly, their own safety. And that would mean physical safety and financial safety. And in this way, I really see Princess Mysteria as an advocate for a vision of feminism that considers women's burden, but particularly the dual challenges that Black women face from both racism and sexism. And she really saw women's priority to be to themselves and to their families, and only then to a boyfriend or even a husband.
Would it be too much to say that she used her column for social justice, or was it much more on an individual level that she was kind of championing, you know, confidence and pride in yourself?
I think that's such a great question. And I think Princess Mysteria would have said it is not an issue of social justice. I think that she would have said, no, I am counseling each person as an individual. And of course, our concept of social justice did not exist the way that we understand it today, 100 years ago. But the most fascinating thing I think about Princess Mysteria's column is that she almost never mentioned white people. And so in that sense, it was a very different sort of way of us thinking about sort of the blend of racism and sexism. She almost took for granted the kind of suffused racism of the United States at the time, and never felt the need to sort of litigate that. And in fact, I think a lot of this is the fact that for a lot of Black newspaper readers and writers in the 1920s, Black newspapers almost felt like a safe space that were free from the eyes of the white reader, and a place where people could have these conversations among themselves, away from the kind of the overarching white gaze that you would have seen in other places.
So I wonder, when you consider all the research you've done in these advice columns from 100 years ago, what has changed today in our chat rooms? I mean, you mentioned earlier on a little bit of the sarcasm and the self-awareness, but I wonder what if you've said, gosh, something's lost.
So I think that one thing that has changed in advice columns is a sense of universality that existed in the beginning of the 20th century. Today, while there still exist these kind of broad sort of human interest advice columns, some of the most interesting work is being done in these really niche categories. Say Dan Savage talking about sort of sexual health and relationships through a very sex positive lens. The Ethicist in the New York Times with this focus on kind of almost a philosophical approach to morals and ethics. There are advice columns on conceptual art. There are advice columns on parenting up the wazoo. There are advice columns on being a foodie, right? And I think a lot of this is about the creation of the niche market. In a lot of ways, we live in a world where you can use the internet to find the person who's interested in the exact idiosyncratic thing that you are, right? Across the world, we are, you know, no longer defined by geography. We're defined by our most focused interest. And those kinds of really focused advice columns, by and large, did not exist in the beginning of the 20th century. But I think the one thing that actually holds the beginning of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century together is an unquenched need to tell one's tale. Advice becomes just as much about catharsis, about being acknowledged, about being heard. And I think the questions that were asked in the 1920s and 30s, and then moving forward into the rest of the century, really, some of them are concrete, but some of them are just, what do I do? What do I do about my feelings? And you can go on any sort of chat room, any subreddit, any social media Facebook group today, and find those same sentiments and that same sense of being heard in the answers that are received from other often anonymous people on the internet.
Julie Golia is the author of Newspaper Confessions, A History of Advice Columns in a Pre-Internet Age. Thank you for sharing these stories with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor.
And I'm Marcus Smith. How many James Bond movies have you seen? I've seen a couple. I just have to ask you, what do you suppose the CIA does with their retired gadgets? Do they sell them to Hollywood for the next James Bond movie? I don't think so. Not quite. The CIA puts many of them on display in an internal, publicly inaccessible museum. What for? Well, for future generations of agents to study, of course. We'll get as close as we can on Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Near Washington, D.C., in Fairfax County, Virginia, stands the George Bush Center for Intelligence. You can just call it CIA headquarters. That works. And as you might expect, it is not an open-access facility. The public cannot just walk in. And that makes it kind of difficult to visit the CIA Museum, which is there. Fortunately, the CIA Museum wants to share exhibitions, and so they kind of go on the road with items shared with major institutions away from the George Bush Center, presidential libraries and such places. Or you can go online and find some pretty cool stuff the way I did. I have already seen a German Enigma machine used for encryption during World War II. I've seen a photo of a micro-unmanned aerial vehicle in the guise of a dragonfly. I'm not going to be trusting the dragonflies I see much more. That was developed in the 1970s. How about a radio receiver concealed in a tobacco pipe? That kind of stuff. Janelle Nisus has been with the CIA for 10 years and currently serves as CIA Museum's deputy director. She oversees the museum's outreach to the public. And she does what is within bounds to help demystify the CIA's mission, its history, and its personnel. She's on the line with us right now. Janelle Nisus, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to share some of our stories today.
So a lot of this conversation we're going to have deals with materials that have been declassified. You don't have a museum and put stuff on that's secret. And so does it tend to be older stuff, 10, 20, 30 years old?
So one of the things that we have to do when we put something out on display is check with the classification. We want to make sure that any of our artifacts that are out there, that we can tell the full stories as much as possible. So most of our artifacts, except the technology, are usually fairly on the unclassified side, but it's the stories that go with them. And that's really what matters, right? It's the object that is our vehicle to tell the stories. And so we have a great group at CIA that works with us to make sure that we don't put anything out that would give away any kind of tradecraft or methods or endanger any of our people. But what we do is we try to make sure that we're telling the full story, whether it's something in the Cold War or something that happened after 9/11. A lot of the artifacts that we have after 9/11 were able to get declassified a little quicker. But we do have items that go all the way back to the 60s, 70s, and 80s that are still classified because of where they were used or how they were used, or because we're still doing something very similar and we want to make sure that we can keep doing that so that we can have our mission to bring, you know, national security to this country. We don't want to give anything away. Even if I think it's a really cool object, it's going to stay locked up for a while.
One of the nice things about museums that put things on display is oftentimes you've got, well, it's just the physicality of it where you can see a device, a gadget, an artifact of some kind. Is the preponderance of what you have on display in the museum of that nature, that it's, I don't know if gadgetry is the right term, but physical equipment?
Yeah, actually, we have some really cool artifacts that seem like they're out of a James Bond movie. But the technology is, like you said, it's mostly from the 60s, 70s. Very few items from our Office of Technical Service or our Director of Science and Technology are on display that were created after like the 1980s, just because we're still sort of keeping track of that technology, possibly still using it or modifying it. And so we want to protect that tradecraft. But the dragonfly you mentioned, that was created in the early 1970s, late 1960s. And it was really the first UAV that was made to look like an animal. Our officers in the science and technology area actually went to the animal kingdom quite a bit to be inspired. And I have it on display at the museum, and it looks just like a dragonfly. The problem with it, though, was if it got into winds that were more than 5 miles an hour from a side wind, it would take it off of its trajectory. But one of the things at CIA is a lot of things in the museum are there so that we can learn from failures and successes. And so something like the dragonfly, even though it wasn't ever used on in an operation or on a mission, it really sort of put forward the stimulation into finding things like it and creating things better that we could use in the years to come. We have things that were used during the Cold War, listening devices, hidden cameras, cameras that are inside a brooch, listening devices that you would really never notice seismic detectors that were used on the Ho Chi Minh Trail during the Vietnam War that looked like tiger dung. Again, the animal kingdom definitely was an inspiration for our officers from time to time. But there's a good balance of the technology side, as well as the analytic side, our support. We have so many different elements to the success in our missions that we try to put all of it on display.
Now, as long as you've mentioned Animal Kingdom, I'm going to stay right there because I just love the story of dead rats. This has to do with surveillance, I'm guessing. What's the dead rat story?
So the dead rat is actually a dead drop. So one of the things that the museum does is try to demystify or kind of get rid of some myths about the agency, whether it's how we're portrayed in movies and television. And one of the things is a lot of times people will think I'm a CIA agent, right? But I think it's important for your listeners to understand that people who work at the CIA are officers. And the people that we recruit and work with overseas to give us information and to gather intelligence, those are our agents or our assets. And so in this case, if you're working in an area that has high counterintelligence, which means you're being surveilled and it's really not safe for your asset to meet you in person, you're going to deploy something called a dead drop. And so our officers in the Office of Technical Service, they're going to try to make the dead drop so that it either is so gross that no one will ever pick it up, or it is something that just blends in and you don't really notice at all. And so with the rat, you probably can imagine it checks both of those boxes. It's pretty gross. No one's going to pick up a dead rat on the side of the road or in an alleyway. And it also blends in specifically in the areas we were using it. We were using it in sort of the Russia area and then also in an area in Africa.
You say nobody is likely to go want to pick up a dead rat, but that's not the same as saying nothing is, because there were cats in this story too.
Sure. Yeah. So one of the things that we learned was that cats were picking up our dead drops during the testing phase. Obviously, if you have two people risking their lives to pass information back and forth. So the thing about the rat was we would carve out the inside, basically make a cavity, and then you could put a small Minox camera in there. You could put film. You could put a one-time, you know, coded message, a one-time pad, and then sew it up and place it somewhere. But all of a sudden, you're missing your dead drops because a cat is taking them. So we didn't want to give up on the rat, though. We thought that it would work really well in these areas. And so our officers, they tried a variety of things. They tried things like cayenne pepper, Tabasco sauce, and wormwood oil. And this acted as an animal deterrent. So they actually would be given these, and they would douse the rat in this before placing it for their asset or agent to pick it up. And it worked fairly well. One of the things that is really kind of a side story that's fun is they actually had to dye the rats sometimes with men's hair dye to make it look specific to the area or region we were using it. So CIA goes sort of above and beyond to make sure that we're really making sure that it really does blend in and doesn't look suspicious.
If you're going to bring a rat carcass with materials in it and do a dead drop and have some, how low can you fly? Does it come from an airplane, from a helicopter? I mean, I don't know.
Usually with our dead drops. So we had an officer who had a very high value asset in Moscow, and they never met in person. They completely used dead drops for the entire time that they were working together. And usually what she would do, because she was a woman and at the time the KGB sort of was very sexist and didn't really surveil her as much, is she would actually walk and place dead drops in certain locations, leave them there. And there was a certain amount of time in between when she was supposed to drop the dead drop and place it and when he was supposed to come along so that they never crossed paths. So usually when we were deploying a dead drop, it would be done with a physical placing by the CIA officer, the case officer.
Okay, that clarifies the thing for me because I'm always going for the high drama. You know, I've seen too many movies and I'm imagining this rat coming flying out of the sky and then somehow it has to be cushioned when it lands. But that's not the way it happened.
Not in this case, no.
Okay. As long as I've mentioned sky and planes, I was just mesmerized by watching video on YouTube of the skyhook procedure for retrieving not just supplies or materials, but people and yanking them up into an airplane. Can you walk us through the Skyhook thing? And along the way, tell me if you'd ever be willing to do it yourself.
So I'll answer that first or that second part first. No, I have no fear of heights. But when you watch the video footage of the Skyhook operation, it's like parachuting, but far scarier because you're literally being yanked and pulled up with a rope system onto a plane. We have people at the CIA who are incredibly brave and make sacrifices for this country every day. I unfortunately will not be one of them that's getting pulled into a plane like that. I just don't have it in me. But yeah, so Skyhook is a really good example of how, so the CIA creates things that are just amazing all the time, our technology, our gadgetry. But we also look to what's being used in the public, because sometimes a mission happens really quick and we don't have time to create something from scratch. And so they sort of have this saying, it's called COTS, commercial off the shelf. So we might get something and modify it a little. And in this case, we had people within the CIA who knew of a system called the Fulton Skyhook system. And when it was discovered that the Soviets had abandoned a research lab in the high Arctic, we knew that we wanted to go and get down there and gather all the intelligence we could, take pictures to figure out what they were doing. At this time in history, this is early 60s, I believe in 1961, they basically were vying for scientific understanding of the Arctic and how it could be used for military purposes. So we weren't just in an arms race. We were also in a race to figure out where the strategic places that the Soviets are going to be, where the Americans going to be, for those advantages. And so when we found this base, this site, we decided we needed to go down and get it, but it wasn't very safe to just land a plane on it. And so what the CIA did, the Naval Research actually started Project Cold Feet, but ran out of money. And so the CIA took it over, and we worked with two amazing men, Leshak and James Smith, and they were willing to parachute down onto this Arctic floe, take pictures, gather all the intelligence, get it in bags. And then a plane came and actually used the Fulton Skyhook system to capture all of the intelligence that we bagged up and pulled it back onto the plane. That's amazing in itself, but now they have to actually get pulled onto this plane. Unfortunately, and you can see it on our website, there is an actual card that teaches you how to use the Skyhook system. You're supposed to be facing against the wind and sort of in a sitting position. And because the wind was so strong that day, when Leshak started to get pulled up, he was actually dragged across the ice for over 300 feet. He had a very uncomfortable ascension into the plane. And when Smith actually was getting pulled, the same thing happened, but he was able to get his boot in a crack on the ice and it turned his body so that he could get pulled up in the proper way, so it wasn't as uncomfortable and painful. The fact that these men were able to do this and that we were able to utilize this technology, it just shows sort of the bravery. And I hope your listeners can watch the video to understand how insane it looks, but it was actually very effective. We were able to get so much intelligence that during the Cold War, every little piece to the puzzle was very important because the CIA was giving intelligence via things like the Presidential Daily Brief to policymakers. And this allowed President Reagan to make better decisions. It allowed presidents before Reagan, you know, all of them needed to sort of know what's the full picture here. And so just by doing this mission in the Arctic, we gave the presidents more pieces to the puzzle so that they could make better policy decisions.
Now, there is another story even higher than airplanes, and it has to do with satellites. And this is back to the era of Francis Gary Powers and the U-2, you know, that the downing of that aircraft and him being taken captive and all of that. And then I guess that in order to gather intelligence, we went to a satellite system. And was this the Corona satellite?
Correct. And so one thing that I think is interesting that deals with the Gary Powers story is after he was shut down, it wasn't just that we were looking to create satellites, which Corona was the first successful reconnaissance satellite launched. We also were looking to fly higher and faster. And so the CIA worked very hard and very quickly with Lockheed to create the Oxcart A-12, which flew at Mach 3. We have one on our compound. It's part of our collection. It's called a macro artifact because it does not fit in the building. But that is also a really interesting story of how basically CIA created this, one of the highest, fastest flying airplanes to ever fly in the sky. And so while that's happening, though, we're also working on the idea of satellites, because we really wanted to get to a place where we weren't risking our pilots. We didn't want them to be captured. We didn't want them to be shot down. We have multiple pilots that have flown for the CIA on our memorial wall in headquarters. And so with Corona, it really gave us this opportunity to take the pictures we needed to add another piece to the intelligence puzzle without risking lives. And so when Corona was launched in one mission, it actually took more photos and gave us more information than all U2 missions combined that happened prior. It was one of those things where Corona kind of revolutionized the collection of intelligence for the United States. And it ran from 1960 to 1972. One of the main reasons, as I mentioned, that we did it was we wanted to have safer options to gather this intelligence. But it also was an option to really get some better real time, right? With Corona, we were able to take pictures. It would drop them into, the film would get rolled into a canister, and it would get dropped into a parachute bag. And then a plane would actually come and retrieve it with sort of like a trapeze hook. So we actually have the canister in our new, our newest exhibit, which is called Collect, Conceal, and Communicate. And there's also a bag, a parachute bag, that was used to sort of get the film safely to the earth so that our officers could develop the film and figure out what was going on in a certain place or time. It goes back again to informing the policymakers. At this point, Corona's main mission was to figure out if the Soviets' arms race was really going as strong as we thought. We wanted to see if they were building up faster than us. And so with Corona, we were able to realize that that wasn't the case. And it allowed the president to make, again, better policy decisions, but budgetary decisions too. You know, we didn't want to bankrupt this country trying to compete with something that didn't exist, but that the Soviets were trying to influence us into thinking was their reality. So Corona really saved us in a lot of ways from making some pretty costly mistakes.
I'm still trying to work through my mind through the mechanics of this. There's a satellite taking pictures. Mm-hmm. It puts the film into a canister. The canister is dropped from some orbit?
Correct. So the canister ends up in a parachute bag. It looks sort of like an army duffel bag, and it has rivets on it and a parachute. And it basically could sense when it was in the drop zone area where it would deploy the parachute. And then the plane would come and fly at the same level, and it would catch it almost like a trapeze artist catches the person that's jumping to them. It would hook it, and it would reel it back in onto the plane, get it back to the earth, and then we develop it.
That's really astonishing. I mean,
there's a video of that online too, if any of your listeners want to see it. It's pretty mind-blowing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking, even from low orbit, I'm thinking about the reentry thing, that you know, all of the reentry issues of heat and fire and that kind of thing. Somehow it's devised to withstand coming through the atmosphere. I don't know.
Yeah, we have, as I mentioned, we have people who work at the CIA who I would compare to Sheldon Cooper, you know, from The Big Bang Theory. They are some of the smartest people you will ever meet in your life, and they use their talents to keep this country safe, and it's really inspiring.
The public doesn't get to walk into this museum, so why does the CIA even have it?
The biggest reason that our museum exists is for our current workforce. You can learn so much from past, you know, failures and successes. And so our museum is actually in a hallway, which again seems very strange. There are offices, you know, office doors, people going to and from work, and that's the idea. The people who work at the CIA are very, very addicted to their jobs. And I mean that in the best way possible. And that's what the American public deserves. And so there isn't a lot of time for an officer to take time away from their job to go to a museum. So the idea of having it in a hallway, it allows officers, as they're going to meetings or to lunch, coming in and out of the building, to stop, you know, every once in a while at a different case and really take in some of their history. And then our museum is very important when it comes to our U.S. intelligence partners and government partners. We also have foreign liaison partners that we work with. I don't know if people realize how successful we are solely based off of the fact that we have these relationships where they can come to the museum and get a much better idea of how in past missions we've all come together to gather this intelligence and to bring about a better outcome. It's a key element of building positive relationships, honestly. And then the other reason, one of my favorite reasons, is even though it's not physically open to the public, the CIA Museum is really one of the greatest tools the CIA has for dispelling myths, because the public has an opportunity to learn directly from the source, right? The artifact. The artifact is something that's real, it's tangible. And then from that, they can learn about these amazing people and missions and how they're intertwined with that artifact. And so it really allows us this opportunity to dispel myths and misperceptions and have a really, really close tie to the reality of the CIA. I always tell people that we're just ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And that could be said about some of our objects. We really try to gather the history as it's happening. And sometimes the artifacts don't really seem like they would be that important, like just a normal notebook, a cheap notebook you could get at Target. But it's a notebook that was used after 9/11 by one of our first officers into Afghanistan. And in that notebook are all the notes he took, who he was meeting, hand-drawn maps, receipts of money that he was spending. And now you have this incredibly clear picture of what it looked like in those first days after CIA got into Afghanistan. I mean, we had the first boots on the ground 15 days after 9/11, and we were taking the fight directly to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and trying to find bin Laden. And all of that is in this $2 notebook. So it's really one of those things where now the public can see something and they know, okay, that was there and it did this, or it was used for that, and get a much clearer picture of what our organization is really all about and what we're trying to do to keep America safe.
One last footnote. I'm going back to the dead rat, the dead drop. That's the kind of thing that I can't imagine the carcass comes home. And you're not going to have one of those in your museum, are you?
We do. So we actually have two rats. One used to be in my office, but it kind of freaked people out. And the other is in our collect, conceal, communicate case. And it's there because, so I think that it's a good symbol of sort of the idea of collect, conceal, communicate. We have a very specific mission at the CIA, and three key elements of that are collect, right? We need to gather intelligence, and we need to conceal how we gather that intelligence. So our tradecraft, our people, and then we have to communicate either between a CIA case officer and their asset via a dead rat and a dead drop, or maybe it's a one-time pad, which is also in the case. And then we need to take that and communicate it to our intelligence partners and U.S. policymakers via things like the president's daily brief, which is also in this new exhibit, because that is a form of communication, right? We're communicating all the different intelligence we've gathered via the PDB, the president's daily brief. We want to make sure that people understand sort of our mission, and collect, conceal, communicate is a really good way of sort of breaking down what we do and who we are.
Janelle Nisus, it's a pleasure to have a chance to learn a little bit from you. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Janelle Nisus has been with the CIA for 10 years, currently serves as the CIA Museum's Deputy Director. The CIA surveils and investigates and analyzes. So do epidemiologists. In a very close analysis, what do rabies and COVID-19 have in common? We'll learn from a veterinary epidemiologist in our ongoing Constant Wonder intelligence gathering. I'm Marcus Smith.